So, welcome to the Alton Brown Cast, a little audio project I put together because I miss adult conversation. Adult conversation free of the agendas so often inflicted by publicists, handlers, and press hounds onto late-night chat shows. Adult conversation free of invasion by phones, tablets, laptops, or any of their ancillaria. And no, not all of the conversations you're going to hear here will be food-centric. There are other things to talk about. That said, following today's chat, I will attempt to answer a small collection of culinary queries from the interwebs. But first, I'm not going to lie. I don't remember exactly how I came across the work of Ellen Bennett, but I do remember tapping her startup apron company, Headley & Bennett, to make an Alton Brown signature apron for an online retail endeavor that went the way of most online retail endeavors. Flash forward a year later, and I finally met the Perma Pixie in person at her tiny manufacturing closet in LA's garment district. I later found out she'd invited a bunch of friends over just to make the place look busy. Anyway, today, the Headley & Bennett showroom and factory take up an entire building, and it's nearly impossible to find a decent restaurant in America where the aprons don't bear the company's Amber Sand logo. I managed to get Ellen to sit down long enough for a conversation, but I gotta tell you, it wasn't easy. Alton Brown on the Alton Brown Cast, and I've brought in today someone that I've wanted on the show for a while, Ellen Bennett. And tell everybody what you do, Ellen, because not everybody that listens to this knows your magnificent works.
All right. Well, I started an apron company almost 4 years ago called Headley & Bennett, and the whole purpose of it was to create a better uniform for every man, woman, child out there in the world so that you could feel and look better, cook better, look like a boss, professionally on the line.
I'm trying to remember when I first saw your aprons, and I no longer can remember that. I remember when you and I first spoke, because it's been a couple of years.
Oh, it's been longer than that.
Actually, yeah, because you started doing aprons for me when you were still just in your first year.
When I was literally in my living room.
Yeah, before you moved into the Eensy Beansy factory.
Exactly. The 400 square foot
now
factory.
Has given away to the mega factory complete with zipline
and
everything like that.
And I have to admit a little secret to you. This is really funny. When you came to visit our factory, our mini room, our 400 square foot space, we only actually had two employees. So we brought in like four other friends to fill the room as our quote unquote employees.
Well, it worked because it kind of had this startup feel, and everybody seemed to like, you know, PR
people. We're six people strong, but really we were just two people strong. The other ones were fillers.
Well, in that space,
after all this time, I've confessed it to the man himself.
All right. Well, I half of the people that are in my office whenever you go are probably just looking for a handout. So I understand that completely. I want to get this straight. Headley was your grandfather.
Correct.
So when you decided, because I love this story, and of course, I mean, I've read a lot of stuff about you. You know what? Let's back up. There are a lot of entrepreneurs. There are a lot of startups. A lot of people making good products. A lot of people have great ideas. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of great ideas, and there are people that are pretty good at business, and there are people that have vision. Yada 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 yada. But somehow or another, within a very short period of time, every cook in America has Headley & Bennett aprons. Yeah, you got the whole bubbly thing going, and you've got apparently energy that comes from supernatural kinds of places. Oh, explain it to me.
Okay. So right around the time when you and I did our collaboration, I started going to all kinds of food events, and just the scrappy gorilla way built the business. So I would go to Pebble Beach Food and Wine with my chef, who I still worked for at the time, and I would be like, I want to come work for you for free. Let me come. And then on the line, I would literally hit up every chef that was standing there. So it was like Tyler Florence, Josiah Citrine, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And be like, hey, I have aprons. I want to show them to you. I'm thinking about this idea. Can I come by and show you? And then I would walk out of there and I would have sold them aprons in my little meeting with them. So I would pick their brain, do my sort of market research. but then also end up selling them aprons. And it was all very collaborative. It's like they wanted to be a part of it. I wanted to make aprons for them and I wanted to learn.
So you saw a vacuum, which is that you looked around in kitchens that you were working in. You were like, all these aprons suck.
Yes.
Aprons used to be really, really bad. I mean, really we all shitty. Wore the same white crappy aprons that were provided from whatever service was handing things out. So you're working and you see, wow, we could improve this radically. And you had somebody you were working with who's both a carpenter and a seamster. How do you say that?
Yeah, and that guy who made that first apron for me was actually just a friend who I went to his house and I said, can I cook for you? And you'll show me how to make a pattern. And that was how I was managing my deals here at the beginning of Hedley and Bennett. I didn't have any money, so I was bartering my cooking services to people so that they would teach me how to make a pattern, how to make the style, how do I get the pockets right, where should I go collect fabrics. It was all through the grapevine, you could say.
Did you get a fire in the belly for aprons, or did you get a fire in the belly for answering a need?
I got a fire in the belly for myself to feel better, if that makes any sense. I was cooking crazy hours all the time and thinking...
Meaning on the line, life on the line.
Yeah, literally, what you're talking about. Just exactly. Yeah. Life in the kitchen, in a professional kitchen, in a 2 Michelin star kitchen. So here I am.
By the way, Michelin's a tire company. I just want to point that out. People go on and on about Michelin stars. I'm so like, why do we worry about this? No, I'm kidding.
So I was working, you know, this crazy job thinking, how are we doing this, making amazing food? And you look around and everyone just like looks and feels terrible about themselves. And I also am a runner. So I sort of jammed the two concepts together and thought, if you can run and look amazing in an outfit, why can't you do that in the kitchen too? And cooking is kind of like a sport. So in my mind, I just went, click, I need to make clothes for the kitchen because kitchen land is like a sport. Hence, the sport needs to look good too.
But there were people already making uniforms. They were making better chef's coats. I mean, chefs wear have been around, 15 years by
and a lot of people compare me to her because she used to sell the pants out of her trunk, the trunk of her car.
A startup.
Yeah, total startup. And I guess the difference is I brought more design to it. I was not getting inspired by other chef clothes. I was getting inspired by Theory, Helmut Lang, Rag and Bone, Brooks Brothers, things that really looked cool and felt cool and had some thought to it instead of just like, oh, well, this will look decent and it's less baggy than the last guy made it. I wasn't into that.
Now, you've just named some pretty heavy fashion names, but when you were a kid, you hung out in Home Depot.
Yes, this is true. You really have researched me.
And that's different because what that says is that you understand the concept of tools.
Totally.
So an apron, I mean, that really rides the line, doesn't it, between a uniform and a tool. It is a functional piece of operational hardware.
Exactly. So it's like I wanted to make a sexy Home Depot, you could say, because you go to Home Depot and everything's pretty straightforward, but I loved how you could go in there and create anything, right? So it was the same concept. Life was my Home Depot. So I was like, oh, well, there's this fabric and there's this fabric, but I want to make it prettier, but I want to make it functional. So that's where you and I sort of meet eye to eye because I love functionality. I love something being there for a reason. I like the pocket to be for the tweezer. I like the corner to be for the towel loop. Like there's reasons for all the pieces of our aprons.
So your first apron, do you remember the first one?
Yes, I do. I'll never forget it.
Did you save it? Do you have it?
Or I'm not going to lie. It got lost in the move to the big factory.
Are you serious?
Yes.
An artifact like that?
Yes. It's the worst. Because
that should have been like framed, you know, with number one on it. Apron
it's
one.
It's true. Yes. It was a yellow canary linen apron with a little bobby pin, literally, holding up the strap that I had attached it because I really didn't know how to attach the straps at that time. So I just sort of rammed it in. A safety pin, actually.
Why was it canary yellow?
That's my favorite color. I love yellow. I think it's bright, it's fun, it's happy, and it's sort of on the line of unisex. It's not too girly, it's not too manly. It's just right in the middle. I even only use yellow emoji hearts on my Instagram. It's a thing.
I hadn't noticed that. I need to pay more attention, clearly.
Pay more attention to my
Instagram.
Emojis, Alton.
You know, I don't put much attention to my own emojis. oh, wait, I don't use emojis. Yeah. Well, except for the little turd. I use the little turd.
Oh, that's good. That's classic.
You know, it's classic and very expressive.
I like the hands up, hands up in the air emoji and the dancing flamingo girl.
I have so much to learn.
Yes, you do.
That I haven't gotten into. So you make this first set of aprons, 40 or something, right? It was
40,
like 40 aprons.
That's right.
For a chef that doesn't matter, here in L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And you get money.
Yeah.
Money is given to you for these aprons.
Me.
And you're standing there now with the money from the aprons. And is that when you realized, oh,
so much
this
money.
Could be a business. This well, no, but I mean, that
it
doesn't
wasn't
matter,
so
right?
much
somebody,
money.
You made something that had not existed.
Yep.
That you believed in, and somebody put money in your hand. Was that the actual moment when you saw clear through to, I will own a factory and I will become the apron lady? Or was it a little like, okay, well, I'm going to do this other job and I'm going to keep making these on the side? At what point did this kind of cottage industry hobby, really, I think is what it must have been in a way, all of a sudden become a feasible
thing?
Empire. We'll call it an empire.
My apron empire?
Your apron empire. Your empire of aprons.
So once I made the actual full order, put it through, put it in the kitchen, was using the aprons I was making because, might I add, the first client I had was my chef too.
So
I was
still
actually
cooking there, under that
cooking
chef.
There with my apron on while working for him. So he became my guinea pig, my test bunny, my everything. And he was like, the strap's not working. This isn't da da da. And we fixed all this stuff because I thought, well, shoot, he's my first customer. I better make him happy. So I fixed all these errors that had happened on them. And at that moment, it was something snapped inside of me in a good way. And I thought, oh, wow. I love making people happy. I love making something that they can't make themselves. And very, very similar to cooking, when you make something delicious and you put it in front of someone's face and they go, wow, that same thing happens with aprons. So it's like this hybrid of Home Depot and my design love and my love for food became an apron. And that was the epiphany moment, you could say. Of I freaking love this and I want to do this for every person I can get my hands on.
If the lightning had not struck, if your friend had not traded you food for a pattern, if that first chef had been, Ellen, your aprons suck and get out, would you have made it in the kitchen in a restaurant environment? Would you have made it? Would you now today be a restaurant chef?
You better freaking believe it.
Would you?
Absolutely. That was my goal. I was well on my way. That was what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a chef.
Yeah, but did you have it though? Because I'll tell you right now.
Yeah.
I'll tell you right now. I did my time on the line.
Yeah.
And hope to never set foot on a hot line again for the rest of my life. I mean, I did it because I knew that I wanted to make TV shows about food, but I knew that I wouldn't have cred.
Yeah.
I wouldn't know. I wouldn't really know if I didn't do it, you know?
Right.
And so I spent enough time
a whole
doing
lot of
it.
Time in there.
But, you know, if I for a long time, once I started making Good Eats, I would wake up in a cold sweat having dreamt of being back on the line on Saturday night in the weeds with, you know, the squirrel chirping out orders and the expediter freaking out.
Right.
Those were nightmares.
And
those were nightmares.
All hell breaking loose.
And that's what I realized is that, you know, I didn't have a plan B. My plan B was never going to be a chef in a restaurant because.
Well, I quickly realized while working at Providence that I didn't necessarily want to own my own restaurant, which had been my goal. I thought, I don't want to do this. But I always knew that I wanted to do something in the food space, whether that was me be the owner of something or cook. I wanted to be in the food space. So
Do you consider yourself in the food space?
Absolutely. And sometimes on Friday nights when I'm really, you know, not doing great or super overwhelmed with whatever, I'll go down the street to Bestia and I'll pop on the line on a Friday night.
Shut up. At Bestia?
Yes. At Bestia.
Bestia is like my favorite restaurant
in
Los Angeles.
And Ori pretty much has given me open reign of his kitchen because he says I'm good enough to make it in there. So
The line is hot.
Yeah, it's very hot and very yelly. A lot of yelling.
Yeah. But well, it's a very loud restaurant. Bestia is not a quiet place.
But I love it because I fit in like a glove because they're all a bunch of maniacs. And I myself am a maniac. So I'll literally roll in like at 6:37. They're in the middle of freaking service. And I'm like, I'm here to cook. And they're like, come on in, girl. So I'll jump on the grill. I'll jump on the line. I'll go to plating. I'll do all and anything.
Favorite position then?
There,
yeah.
I love grill.
I would always, that grill was always my spot on the line.
It's just exciting, and you're right there in the fire, and you're seeing it, and then you also get the plate.
Well,
I don't know, it's just really
they're
fun.
Cooking on charcoal there, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the real thing.
It's
so
the real deal.
I don't,
fire.
I don't want gas.
Fire.
Don't give me gas. I want. I also really like wood fire ovens.
You know, Rick Bayless just opened an entire all fire restaurant.
Which I think is a fantastic concept.
Squad.
Are they?
Yeah,
you have to make them some
are.
Kind of like fire retardant or insulated, you know, models
true.
Because working a pizza
models.
Oven, you know, or is
personal
horribly
chimneys.
Hot.
Yes.
Yeah. You might seriously think about that. I mean, I would jump back on the line. I don't know. I'm glad that I don't have to, but you probably realize
but I do it once in a while. Point is I can do it. I love doing it.
Okay.
And it brings me, but you know what I love about it? I love that it's doing what you're doing when you're doing it.
Now you've got to face the fact, or maybe it's not that difficult to face, that you've made more of a mark and are more a part of the food world making aprons than you are cooking. Is that at all smart? Is there any disappointment in that, or do you feel fortunate that you found the thing that you're supposed to do and the way that you're supposed to make the food world better?
I definitely feel very fortunate. I think that a lot of people are looking for their version of an apron in life. Like, what is the thing that makes you tick? What is the thing that makes you get up in the morning and like hustle, move hard? For me, it definitely is the apron, but it's also taught me a lot about myself, the world, people. Dealing with, I mean, essentially what I did was go from being a line cook to a CEO in a very small period of time. And that took its toll on myself as a person. Because,
what kind of toll?
Well, because it was a humongous learning curve. And it came with the good, the bad, and the ugly. I'd never fired anybody. I'd never hired anybody. I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know the legalities of all these things. And I've loved it. It's been amazing. But it's definitely not been easy. It living out your dream is not as easy as it looks when you just see the pretty stuff on Instagram. You don't see all the time when you're working your buns off and nobody's seeing it, or all the hours or the nightless nights where you're thinking about stuff. That's the part that is what makes it so exciting, but it's also the hard part.
Yeah, but you know something of stepping out of a normal role to assume responsibility.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, you made sure your mom's mortgage was paid. You paid the family bills from the time you were like 14.
Yes.
So this begs the question. I don't know nor do I want to know the circumstances of your folks getting divorced. But had you not stepped into at least a junior managerial role in your household when you were a kid, do you think you would have been able to make the transition, as you say, the radical transition from line cook to CEO as quickly as you did?
No, definitely not. I think that I look at that time in my life and I am grateful for the downfalls that we had as a child or that my family had, because it made me way more of the person that I am today, for sure. Like, I have no sympathy for myself in any way, shape, or form. If anything, I'm grateful that I had to step up, because it's true. Then I went from line cook to CEO, and it wasn't so crazy. It was just sort of like, okay, I got to figure this out. And I think a lot of it was that. I got to figure this out. Okay, I'm going to do it. Just how I figured out how to pay my mom's mortgage when I was 14. I was like, I'm going to do this. And then I did it. And that's really exciting. So now that I'm 28... It's kind of like every day since I've turned 25, I've been in Harvard Business School every day, but in life. Sort of Harvard Business School meets Shark Tank, and every day I'm learning something new, and there's war wounds along the way, but it's also pretty freaking exciting, because it's my game, it's my creation, and I can make it as big or as little as I want. And that's what I tell my staff every day. I'm like, this is our dream and our opportunity, and we can go huge or we can go small, but it's totally up to us what we choose to do with it. And I want to make it huge. I want to be like the Nike of the culinary world. That is my goal. I want to be gigantic, but in the best of ways, so that we have this huge community of people wearing our aprons and our products and feeling and looking awesome, and not just feeling like there's some dude in a kitchen that can't make it in the world, but them wearing my stuff can make them feel like they will one day also be huge and whoever it is that they want to be. And it's not even in kitchens anymore either. It's like carpenters and painters and potters and all these other people are now also wearing our aprons, and they're aspiring to live their own dreams and figure out what their quote-unquote apron is too.
I actually know people that are home cooks. I think that one of the great, I don't want to say compliments that can be paid, but when you realize that you're affecting people in an area outside of your usual realms, like I know just home cooks now who have your aprons and feel that it's somehow like up their tool game.
That's,
you know,
amazing.
And so now that you've tipped over, I mean, you solely went after the restaurant trade,
yeah,
and professionals.
Yep.
What has been your strategy to start now moving out of that and into, we'll say, enthusiast cooks?
Yeah. Well, we're on a ton of TV shows, so we outfit like half the shows on Food Network, all the baking championship shows, and we also started working with a ton of bloggers and social media influencers to get our stuff in front of even more home cooks. And we also created the factory so that we could have a space where we could throw events. So we've gotten together with amazing people and said, hey, we're going to throw a party. We're going to throw a dinner. We're going to throw a brunch, a lunch. And we just continue to maintain that sort of scrappy grassroots approach to how we grew the business, even now when it's big.
Where would your venture be right now had not this thing called social media happened? Because when you first started social media, I mean, who was Instagramming when you first started? I mean, I wasn't.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's true. It was right around the curve of food people starting to become famous and social media starting to be used. So it was all sort of in that upward curve. I think it would be a lot harder, but at the same time, because I approached it from such a grassroots angle, I did it the old school way. Like, I just finished reading Phil Knight, the founder of Nike's cookbook. His book about shoes. His shoe book, not cookbook. And a lot of what they did is what we did. It was a lot of like going to track meets and going to different events, essentially.
It wasn't just staying up late with a waffle iron.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that a lot of people could be even more successful if they applied some old school ways along with our new school ways. If you combine real world hustle with online hustle, you will be that much more successful, because a lot of people they start to hide behind their computer and their emails. And I was of the approach of just storming up to people and being like, hey, I'm Ellen, I make aprons, I want to talk to you, can I show this to you? And people sometimes were taken aback by it, but eventually they'd come around and be like, yep, I do want to talk to you about aprons. So that I think is like classic old school advice.
So this isn't so much about Instagram, it's about you being a pushy broad.
Exactly. I'm in your face broad.
Has anybody ever just flat out told you that? It's like, hey,
no.
Ellen, you know what? You need to back off just a little bit. Are those your feet in my shoes or mine? I can't tell anymore.
Yet to happen.
Called you out. Nobody's ever said, hey, Ellen, geez, relax. Decaf, Ellen. Decaf.
People say like, wow, she's crazy, but it's always with a smile and they mean it in a nice way. They've never said she's nuts in a bad way.
Now that you've monopolized the apron world. And in fact, you created the apron world, because there wasn't an apron world, mm-hmm, before that. Mm-hmm. You reach out to Japan for fabrics, Spain, Turkey, or you
Europe,
Europe, most certainly for linens and whatnot. So you didn't know diddly jack about the fabric world. How did you get educated about all the stuff that you did not know how to do? Because people don't know really how to get that kind of working knowledge anymore. So I'm really interested in were you always just interested in fabric, or weren't interested until you knew you needed it?
Right. I think it goes back to how I got somebody to make my first pattern. I was just being scrappy and asking questions to everyone and their mother, and asking questions will get you to Rome. Like, you can figure out pretty much anything by asking the right people lots of questions and then applying it.
So one day you said, hey, you turned to somebody and said, who makes the best denim?
I literally a store, and I found a guy who sold really great denim, and then I started picking his brain, and then he introduced me to a guy who had a manufacturing company, and I said, where do you get your stuff? And he was like, oh, you should go down the street over there. Then I went to down the street over there, and then that guy was like, you should check out the leather guy over here, and then that leather guy knew a denim guy. And then you just keep following the train.
Yeah, but eventually the train goes to Japan.
Exactly.
So,
and then if you smile enough and are friendly enough to people and are not a jerk, people are willing to help you. And I, in particular, like to take people's advice. And I think that when there's a good idea, I'll take it and I'll use it. So then people were even more inclined to help me, because they're like, oh, she's actually listening to me. I'm not wasting my time talking to this girl. Because then the next time they'd see me, I'd already rolled out all these other ideas. And then I would get to show them my homework, you could call it.
So, of all,
it's very collaborative.
So you're basically building a collaborative network around the world. When you decide you need Japanese fabric, selvage, whatever you're getting from there, you decided I'm going to Japan. I got to go to Japan to do this.
For example, this was a crazy thing that I did that I shouldn't. I don't even think now, looking back, that I got everything I needed to get out of it. But I was like, I need to learn about fabrics. I'm going to the biggest textile show in the world. I'm going to China, and I just got on a plane and went to China for like 2 weeks to the world's largest textile convention. I got so many contacts and different things, but it really was just sort of an eye-opening experience of everything that was out there. I don't even think I ended up using very many of the contacts that I got from that show. Point is, I was going out there to find it, and then eventually I would get the things that I needed from other directions. But that was the sort of crazy action that I was taking to do this sort of thing. Not that it made any sense, but it was the way it made sense in my head.
So you go to China.
Yeah.
To the world's biggest textile convention.
Yes.
I assume your Mandarin is not stellar.
Not great.
You traveled with, how many of you went? Or was it just you? Did you just go by yourself?
There was one of these vendors here in LA was going, and he was like, do you want to, you know, you can come if you want. And he thought I was probably going to say no. And then I showed up and I was like, damn right, I'm coming. So I ended up going there and we would meet up and go into the convention together.
And you would just try to soak up all of this.
Yeah. And knowledge. I was just running around like a lunatic. And in just imagine the equivalent of like 13 football fields. Like that's how big this convention place was. It was huge. Huge.
Was there ever a moment where you were like, yeah, this was not the good idea that I thought it was? Or were you always like, yeah, yeah, this is so freaking awesome? Was there never like, how quickly can I get home? Come on.
From China or just life in general?
Well, we'll use China as a metaphor, shall we?
Okay, so yeah, when I was going to China, there was actually someone who called me right before I took that flight, and he was like, you're crazy, you don't know what you're doing, you shouldn't be going to China. And I was like, you know what, I'm going, and I'm on the plane, and I've already left.
So it was like daring you.
Yeah.
Basically is what he did.
Literally.
So you don't like being told you shouldn't do something.
That I can't do something or that I shouldn't do something. Absolutely not.
That usually leads to people making what are called mistakes. Are you familiar with this concept?
In my case, it's more like an exciting challenge. I like doing things the non-regular way. Whether that is the way you're supposed to dress when you're a CEO or...
How are you supposed to dress? Do people think you don't look like a CEO? I don't even know what that it means.
I don't even know. Exactly. You look at all these guys and they're wearing like tennis shoes and they own billion-dollar companies. So I don't know what the right CEO dress wear is. But, I think I sort of dress like half little kid meets a cartoon. I don't know.
Which no one would say is CEO.
But, no.
But back to the mistakes.
Yes, yes. Tell me about those.
No, I want you to tell me about those. I want to know if there's been one or if there was a moment during this whole thing where you thought, that was bad. I shouldn't have done that.
I think it was a little premature. That was in year one. I think that I could have taken other approaches in Los Angeles to find the information that I found in China. But
did you think that going to China was going to make you a player?
Maybe.
I mean, it was kind of like, maybe. I'm going to this big show in China.
It was almost like I was proving it to myself. I was like, all right, I own a business. I got to make some big moves. I got to get out there in the world. I got to see what's going on. Like, you know, you look at Phil Knight. He went to Japan. I just thought, that's what you do. You got to go out there. And, you know, I came back. And like I said, I did learn lots of good stuff, but I didn't get everything that I needed out of it. I got a lot more out of LA. But I'm glad I did it anyway. I don't regret it. I don't regret it at all.
How many people work for you now?
We have 27 and then about 20 sewers. So 47.
Do people just naturally follow you? I mean, when you're starting something like this, it takes a lot of faith to be like employee number one. No. You're employee number one. It takes a lot of faith to be employee number two.
Yeah,
you know,
it's true.
To bring somebody on is like, who's going to follow me? Who's getting in the boat with me?
It's true.
Who was the first person they got on the boat
with you? My first two employees were very good friends of mine. So they sort of trusted me already. And I had taken a big trip around the world. I had lived in Mexico for 4 years on my own. I had sort of lived a lot of life by the time I was 23 and then went to Providence and then at 25 started Headley and Bennett. So they sort of trusted my instincts. But
they didn't give up their jobs entirely, right?
No, they didn't.
They
no.
Kept some side
Everybody kept their side hustles, including myself. I didn't actually start working full time for Headley and Bennett up and like about a year and a half in, I quit my other jobs. Because I refused to let go of my daily income. I was like, that's too crazy. I can't do that. So I would hustle.
What happened to make you decide to do it? What allowed you to let go?
Well, by the time I let go, we already had our mini office, our 400 square foot office. We had about four employees and we had several hundred accounts. So it was sort of getting to a point where I was working every day at Headley and Bennett, setting up the farmer's market booth on Sundays, working all day, then leaving and going and working at Providence after the farmer's market. So it was sort of like killing myself softly. And then right around that time, my chef was like, all right, like, what are you doing? You know, this is happening over here. Your stuff is really exploding. And his friends were starting to wear my stuff. And it was just sort of like an evolution around him and me, yet I refused to leave Providence. And so finally, I think it just one day I said, okay, enough. I gotta go. And I jumped the nest. And he was very like, anytime you want to come back, you can come and cook. So that for me was my savior. I was like, all right, I have my job essentially. If all else fails, I can come back and work at Providence. So.
Do you still need that? Do you still need that feel that you can fall back on something? Are you fully committed finally?
No, I'm fully committed.
You're in.
I'm in. I'm so in. It's crazy.
Well, now that you've pretty much monopolized aprons in the Northern Hemisphere, what's next? I mean, if you're really going to be Nike.
Yeah, I have a lot to do.
What is it?
Chef coats. We already launched and have been doing that.
Seen those.
Linens, napkins, table runners. Our knife bag is about to roll out. And it is pretty freaking incredible.
I have yet to ever see a decent knife roll
ever on
planet
Earth. You just wait till I show
Earth.
You this one, Mr. Alton Earth. Brown. Mm-hmm. It's on Alton Brown's Earth. Let me tell you. Yes, it is.
Okay. Because I've never actually seen one
it's so beautiful. It's so good.
Did you design it?
Damn right I did.
Did you?
I do all our designs. I am the C-suite. What? I am all the C's of Headley and Bennett and the designer and the founder.
So what happens when eventually somebody comes to you right before the initial public offering and says, you know what, you got to just CEO. You got to let go of the design thing. Will you panic and freak and say no? Or will you hire good designers? When can you start removing hyphens from your title?
From my title.
And I ask this because I am a control freak.
Yeah, well, you can ask one of my staff who's sitting here to your left. I am an OCD control freak myself. But I have let go of a lot of titles. All 27 of those employees that work for me, at one time or the other, I held their role. So I've let go of 27 chunks, if you look at it that way.
All right, well played. Well played. So you're not sewing.
I'm not sewing. I don't even know how to sew. Alton.
Now, how is it that somebody who is so paranoid's not the word. You were so fixated on being a good line cook and being able to do all of these things. Yeah. And yet now your business is built on something you can't make.
I know. It is a crazy concept. Yeah, but I control every aspect of it. We have so many details to make sure that everything is exactly what it needs to be, like tech packs and technical drawings. And we're crazy. We treat my company as if it was a line. We have stations. We have things. We have checkpoints. We have QC points. We're like a kitchen, except we make aprons instead of food.
Except you can't make an apron.
Except I can't make my own food.
I think you should make an apron. You need to make an apron.
Even if
it's a really horrible piece of crap. Just get some yellow. You need
Maybe
to replace.
Maybe we should take some sewing lessons together.
I have a theater degree. That was my college degree. So I took, you know, wardrobe shop. We all had to do it. So
it all makes sense now. You did theater.
I don't sew well.
Bum, ba da bum.
Well, I don't think I'm bump of it on bum. More like bump of it on bum. But you can do the duh because I don't have the energy for the duh. But my father died when I was pretty young. But he was a sewer mm-hmm. of a great many things. He could make almost anything with his hands. And I always fear losing connection with the handheld part of something, which is why I still, on my work, I still grab cameras, I still shoot, I still, you know, do as much of the technical hands-on work as I possibly can. So since you lost through your own amazing negligence apron number one, you should now replace it with one sewn by your own hands.
All right,
I want
maybe
you to go find some yellow fabric and sew.
And sew it up.
And sew apron one.
I think
one.
I can do that.
You own the sewing machines. I'm going to assume you own the machines.
Yes.
You do own the machines. So you should be able to take your top, whoever, like the foreman, or however it works,
and
your lead sewer.
Sewer.
And say, show me how to do this.
All right. Okay, I'll do it. Scout's honor.
And then I want you to send me a picture.
With my beat up hand. Scout's honor.
Well, and I'm a little worried about you getting more scars from, you know, needles. Those that are big, big things.
Aggressive.
So the jacket's happening.
Yes.
So
the
what
jackets,
then happens? Pants the, happen. What?
Yes.
What?
Chef pants. The knife bag.
The linens.
The linens.
Where does it stop?
It doesn't. It doesn't actually stop. It continues to be in the sphere of clothing type things. I have no interest in doing knives and stuff like that. Just
so textile.
Yet.
You're staying in soft goods.
Staying in the textile department, but in the lifestyle, so headed more towards the home cook avenue. So
what do you think home cooks need?
I think everybody needs an apron. They need better pot holders. They need better linens. Just everything upgraded. Everything sort of stuck in the 90s in home cook land. Pot holders, I don't think, have been redone since the 60s. I don't know. They're just all real upgraded.
Well, they have, you know, but you know, and there have been a few companies that have made some real good inroads. The problem, I think the real problem is those of us that are in the trade still reach for side towels. I mean, you know, we still.
It's true. And I still reach for side towels. So I hear you. But the home cook doesn't really understand always the concept of a side towel.
No.
It's a rare occasion.
No, it's true. And let's face it, that market has been completely
saturated.
Well, monopolized by foreign offerings.
Yes,
there's
it's
not
true.
That much American product in table fabrics.
Yeah.
You know, I
which is a big challenge because lots
challenge.
Of companies, of course, have seen what we're doing now and are like, ooh, we're going to do that too. We're going to make aprons that look just like hers, literally to a T.
What I want is a giant tablecloth that like for like a table of 10,
mm-hmm.
where each position has a pocket for people to put their phone away.
Oh, that's amazing.
In the tablecloth.
It just leans over.
I just want like a pocket for the phone right there so that everybody can, you know, Instagram the food and then go
and then
about
put it
their
away.
Business. I'm curious about, because you did mention Instagram, and I see, you know, I watch your feed, and I'm interested in how you feel the general. Obviously, your company is greatly built on the aesthetic of how things look.
Yeah.
And if social media has done anything in the last few years in the food world, it's make people increasingly aware of what things look like, what their food looks like.
Yep.
I mean, I know there are restaurants now where actually lighting designs are being planned around how is this going to be for people taking photos of the food,
right?
Because you
so
need
essential.
That. It's become such an essential thing. How do you think, now that you're really kind of a player in the food world, how do you think that's affected the industry in general, not just your end of the industry, but the food industry in general? And how do you see the food world here in at least America evolving over the next few years, taking all of these things into account, including the work of people like yourself? Wow, that's a big question. I'm so glad I got that out.
I think that for one, food is sort of becoming the new technology. Everybody wants something. Everybody has to do something with it. Everybody eats. And now the technology world is merging with the food world so much so that I feel like we're just a big melting pot between fancy people that like to eat food and then people that don't know how to eat food and then people that are like home cooks and then the famous chefs. And all these people, you could say, are sort of like our clients. And it's how do you help all those people with your product? And so in the food world, I sort of feel like you have so many ideas in different ways of executing food, but for the longest time, it was always done one way. And now it's kind of like people are throwing stuff into this melting pot. And so the food world is being flipped upside down because now you don't just have to worry about making good food. You have to worry about how does it look on a phone? Do you have the right social media people coming to your restaurant? Do you have a PR company? Essentially all businesses are becoming like media platforms. You have to know how to do media to succeed because everyone is on media. So it's this crazy merger is what I see, and you have to understand it or it will eat you alive, and you can have an amazing restaurant, but maybe people don't know about it because you're not in on Snapchat and crazy things that 5 years ago you wouldn't even think about.
I would even say that my argument is that food is becoming its own form of media in a very kind of deep philosophical level, in that it is becoming a switchboard through which change happens and through which communication is made. So
it's very true. I also think that chefs are becoming thought leaders in a really interesting way. And because we have so many different kinds of crisis happening in the world, the fact that a chef can say, hey, this is not good, or like Monsanto is bad, or you should eat these types of grains, and then people actually listen to them, it's kind of extraordinary. And then social media gives them that platform. So it's like, it's kind of mind-blowing how much effects in a good and bad way food can have on the world.
Do you think that that's a good thing?
Yes, absolutely. I think it is a good thing.
Because there are plenty of chefs I know that I would not want to take life advice from. I mean, there are a lot of people that I don't know need to have influence.
No, you're absolutely
right. Should, of course.
You're absolutely right. But then there's also so many amazing chefs that now have a voice, that do have a lot of great knowledge. And they're the ones that really care about, you know, buying the right sustainable fish and getting this crop from here. And they are directly affected by things that maybe, you know, average lady on the corner is not affected because we're using Monsanto. But the chef is, because he buys that every day and he needs it to not be screwed up because it doesn't taste as good. So I think that chefs are directly contributing to the entire world's like food chain, at least in the United States.
Probably in the world.
Yeah.
Probably in the world.
Probably in the world.
You're more concentrated on America, but you must be selling stuff overseas now.
We definitely want to be even more so overseas, but The chefs that I love aren't even in the U.S. It's like Massimo Bottura and Alex Atala. Like, they're not even in the U.S., and I think they're incredible people.
Well, they're probably already wearing your stuff, right?
Massimo is. Alex has yet to, but he's on my hit list. I really want to actually go and cook for him. I want to go cook for and with and outfit him and the whole nine yards.
Do you feel like you keep making references to your cooking.
Yeah.
And to cooking at restaurants, into cooking for chefs. Do you do that partially because you still feel like you want the credit of it, that you want something to prove, that you want them to see that you can do it and that you do understand the world, or do you just like it?
No, I just actually love it. I really do. I've been cooking since I was a little kid, like very little. And it's quite fulfilling. And actually, a few days ago, we had somebody come in and they did a little video on me. And they asked me, make something that you love, that reminds you of something from your childhood. And I made shepherd's pie that I had grown up eating. And then they did a little interview on me. And I actually like burst into tears mid-interview as I was talking about the shepherd's pie. And I was like, wow, I had no idea that this shepherd's pie that I hadn't made in like 15 years would bring me to tears. But that's... Yeah.
Because it connected to something.
Yeah,
because
I was talking about how I felt when I used to walk into my grandma's house and it would smell like shepherd's pie. And that moment, that feeling when I was at my grandma's house. And now they're, you know, Headley and my grandma are passed away. But it really like hit home for me. And if I look at my entire life, it's built on food. I wouldn't have the company that I had that I have if it wasn't for food, if it wasn't for my love for food, if it wasn't for me being a line cook in a restaurant making food. So it's all interconnected to my dreams and my life. And so I love it. Why would I go to Bestia and cook on a Friday night if I didn't love it? That's kind of suicidal.
I don't know if it's suicidal, but it would certainly wake me up.
That's kind of probably why I do it, because it wakes me up. It brings me out of the muck of the week. And then I'm like, just like, the fire, the heat, the knives.
There's something about focus. You know, it's like the hobbies, when I look at the hobbies that I have or have had that I don't have a lot of time for anymore, flying airplanes and riding motorcycles. And the two things were unified by, one, the need for technical knowledge and competence, but above all, the need for focus.
Yeah.
You know.
Wait, you fly airplanes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, my pilot, my dad's a pilot.
I didn't know that. I didn't know that. You told me this. You told me. And he's a captain.
He flies international.
Yeah, international route. So he's coming. He's a big dog. But, you know, you can ask your dad, when it's late at night in a crosswind and you're on final, you're not thinking about anything else.
Totally.
You are totally focused on instruments and reading the airplane and stuff like that. And so, I mean, I think that there is very much that exists on the line as well. But there's one thing that exists on the line that doesn't exist in those other instances, and that is what I call wartime camaraderie.
Oh, for sure.
Because, and I don't want to belittle people that have actually been to war. I have not. But, you know, Saturday night, Friday night at a restaurant like Bestia, when you're on the line,
like
you are utterly in the hands of those around you, and they are utterly in your hands. Do you thrive on that?
Absolutely. Oh my gosh. 100%.
And do you have that? Do you try to maintain that feeling also though in your business?
That is part of the reason I do the cooking on the line. Sometimes when I'm like, gosh, how do I motivate my team? I look around and I see how they motivate each other in a kitchen. And I think, oh, that's what I can do in my own team, in my own office. And so we definitely do stuff that's similar to what a kitchen does to motivate ourselves. Like we'll bring our hands in. We'll do like little yells. We'll run around the table. Like there's certain things we'll do in our little gatherings that I've observed in kitchens that gets the team motivated and going. And I always hope that my staff will act with the due diligence that staff in a kitchen does, because it's like another level of attention to detail. It's like on steroids.
Yeah, it's showing up to work 3 hours before you clock in just to make sure your mise is set up.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know that.
Every business owner loves that.
Sort of illegal to do.
But that love, that die hard, make it, you're going to make it great no matter what. Attitude is what I've learned from a kitchen, and I try to impart that into my own staff. And I think that everyone should do a little bit of time in a kitchen, because it really does teach you stuff that you don't learn anywhere else.
When you're burned out on work.
Yeah.
And maybe even burned out on food. Where do you get it back? What gives it back? Where do you go? What re-energizes you? What refeeds you?
Crazy things like this exercise, this 300-mile bike ride, stuff like that. Running a triathlon. When's the last time
you did that?
4 months ago.
Really?
And then I did this 2 months ago. And before that, I had done a marathon. And before that, like another race. So I set myself these ridiculous goals, because it's the only way I will actually leave the office to mandatorily exercise. Because if it's not a big enough goal, I'll just be like, I'll figure it out. I'll make it work. Meaning I'll kill myself on the race, which I don't want to do. So, yeah, I set myself really crazy goals, and then those motivate me. And that has nothing to do with working. That's just myself, my own drive.
No, but it has to do with moving, which seems to be something you don't stop doing very often.
And I love it because it reminds you of real life stuff. Like I said, I hate getting too caught up in emails and P&Ls and lists and things that don't exist in the real world. I like the real world. That's where I get true inspiration. And so crazy races inspire me. And they remind me that I can push myself further than I think I can go. So when I was on my triathlon, for example, swimming a freaking mile in a lake, you know, you kind of feel like you're going to die, and then you don't die, and then you get out, and then you do another 25 miles on a bike. So it's sort of like push, and then you just keep going and you still make it. And so you've pushed yourself, you've broken a muscle in your mind. I can do this. It is possible. I will keep going.
You've broken a muscle in your mind.
Yeah, just like exercise. You know, you rip a muscle. You rip a muscle and it gets stronger. Every time I do these crazy races, it's like I rip a muscle in my mind and I say, okay, I was able to do that. And then therefore I am stronger for it.
Ellen Bennett, mind ripper. Thank you. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me, Alden.
Been a pleasure. Good luck with the next triathlon.
Thank you.
Right now is the time for a relatively new segment on the Alton Browncast, new this season. We call this the cocktail query time, where questions are asked while we are enjoying cocktails. So it's some melted ice in my glass there. I am sitting with my Dodo, Director of Digital Ops, Sarah Tahir, who watches over all of my massive interwebs estate.
So this, we can go with that.
We can go with that. And what she does is she harvests questions from the interwebs, from Facebook and Twitter, and sometimes even Instagram. And we don't get anything from Snapchat because it would vanish before you could write it down, right?
I mean, we could technically do that, but
we could technically do that. We don't get any questions from Snapchat.
You're not on Snapchat enough.
This is always about some kind of criticism that you've got about how I do my job.
Let's not.
So anyway, Sarah's pulled some questions from the interwebs. I like to have her read them because I don't know what they are. And this way you'll know that I have no idea. So I just can't make up crap. So go ahead. Go. What you got for me this week?
Oh, I'm going to start out with bang since we're drinking right now.
Yep.
Jeff B. from Facebook asks, you gave up alcohol for a little while and took up a serious case for bitters. What are some of your favorite non-alcoholic drinks using bitters?
Well, the old fashioned. Oh,
non-alcoholic. Non-alcoholic.
I have to tell you that during the time that I wasn't drinking, which was far longer than I'm comfortable with, I actually found that a huge assortment of bitters came into my possession, and I found myself putting bitters in darn near everything. I carried when I traveled on airplanes, I would travel with several, because you know bitters are usually in very small containers.
What do you mean when? You still do.
Yeah, I do. I still do. The one I've been carrying lately is that is smoked citrus, smoked orange bitters that I've been carrying in a little jar. Was it Dash Fire? You know that Dash
Fire?
They make the very, very cool square bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Dash Fire's brandy bitters have been very, very, very good to me. I can't remember the name of the company that makes the orange bitters I like so much. I like the ones that Jack Rudy are doing. But I've got probably 100 different bottles. 50. Oh, 1821 here in Atlanta.
Phenomenal.
Oh, my gosh. Down at Pond City Market. If you live in Atlanta, you're coming through Atlanta, go to 1821. They're making their own tinctures, their own infusions, their own bitters there, and they are fantastic. There's an Earl Grey at 1821 that I am absolutely obsessed with. They've got a great chamomile bitters. They're really doing great work there. Anyway, you know, my go-to has always just been bitters on club soda, but because I am so amazingly into bitter, I will remember when we first had you were on tour with me. What city were we where somebody turned me on to the coffee and tonic? You remember the coffee and tonic? And I hadn't had coffee and tonic.
We were just in California for that.
It wasn't Redmond. What was the name of that shop?
It wasn't.
And somebody was like, if you're into bitter, here it goes. And it was like a espresso.
You're talking about the coffee shop that made you.
And apparently it was already a thing. Was it in Red?
No, it wasn't in Redding. Give me a second.
No, it wasn't Redding. You're right. I'm making things up.
Keep going, and then
anyway. So I didn't realize that that espresso and tonic water was already a thing. But let me tell you something: you take espresso and tonic water and coffee bitters. That's almost too bitter for me, and yet somehow I still really like it. And
Riverside.
It was Riverside. What's the name of the shop? Because I'd love to give them a shout out.
Augie's Coffee.
Augie's Coffee, a fantastic coffee shop there in Riverside, California. And they turned me on. They made a really, really nice coffee and tonic. Anyway, if you haven't had that, very, very, very refreshing if you like bitterness. And of course, you know, we should talk about this because, you know, can I segue to tonic water for a second? Because I think this is important.
This is your show.
So, oh yeah, I can do whatever I want. So we're talking about bitters. And by the way, orange bitters in Diet Coke. That's all I try not to drink Diet Coke, but it's good in cola. Bitters and colas are good. Bitters, you know, I found one. There's only one drink that bitters aren't good in. I cannot find a combination of bitters that is good in orange juice.
There's no reason to really touch orange juice, in my opinion, with bitters.
I have come to the conclusion
champagne.
The only orange drink that I really like is the one that is on my website, that's on altonbrow.com, that's the orange drink that's basically my take on Orange Julius, which I think is a really good drink. I love that drink because I grew up on Orange Julius's in California. I don't even know if there is any Orange Julius anymore.
I think there are.
I haven't seen
back
one in
a long Jersey
time.
I feel like, yeah. Oh, that drink is life changing.
Nobody's going to believe you're from Jersey because you're using your non-Jersey voice. right now. You're using your
well, let
broadcast.
Me go open up the drawer for
the
you, and I'll let you
draw,
see the, if what, the dog the, is in there.
The dog is in the drawer.
All right. Can we right. keep talking tonic? Stay on.
All right. So, you know, tonic water was just a way of getting quinine into people in order to stave off malaria. So I'm wondering now, with Zika coming down the pike, goodness. You know, with mosquitoes, if we can't keep them away with more tonic,
I'm pretty sure they would have tried that.
You think?
I think they're on it.
What if the answer to Zika was cocktails? What if?
Nobel Peace Prize.
Nobel, I'll be waiting.
From cocktails to snacks. I know you've got a snack tooth. Lexi A. from Facebook asks, what's your favorite midnight snack? And I know this is pretty, I think, unexpected for those who don't know the answer to this already.
Wait, you know the answer?
I do happen to go on tour with you, and I feel like some people have asked you this question before. Unless you want to change your answer.
Well, what's the answer?
I feel like there's some sort of Fritos and like store-bought caramel sauce that you warm up and dip it into. Yeah, he's not saying anything because I've got it. Nailed it.
But I don't do it on a regular basis. I don't. You can't. No, it's too dangerous.
It would also ruin
but
it.
But yes, Fritos corn chips dunked into the very industrial caramel sauce that they sell at the Mega Mart in the produce department for dipping apples, because kids will eat that stuff.
And apparently adults.
No, I won't put apples in it, but
no,
I'll put Fritos
caramel
in
sauce.
It. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I will dip a Fritos corn chip. The big ones, you know, the really big ones they make for dipping.
I can.
You put that in that caramel sauce and wonderful things happen. You remember where were we where we had Frito pie the old school way where we put the chili in the bag.
Oh, man. That was
with
my
the
first
Fritos.
Frito pie
that was
ever.
For your first one. We got to witness the Jersey girl have that.
We were in the South, weren't
we? I don't remember. The problem with eating on tour is that
it was the beginning of the tour.
The beginning of Eat Your Science, right? It was the Eat Your Science tour. And we actually did it where we dumped everything in the Frito bag
like
and ate out of the
Nashville?
Bag.
That doesn't make sense.
No,
does
it doesn't, because Nashville's where we did the hot chicken
Ooh.
Business.
We should talk about – I'm starting to think that we should talk about A.B. Roadie. It's a little bit when we
– A.B. Roadie's put 20 pounds onto me.
And myself.
It's fair. Wait, what? You're
– Anyway, I think that we should talk about our favorite A.B. Roadie.
Did you get up to a size 2?
I think we should talk about our favorite A.B. Roadie as the 2017 leg.
Well, that can be
– Arranged.
Arranged. All right, let's go to another question because I didn't really answer that one, but it was a long time ago and I've forgotten it. So
your midnight snack.
Oh, the midnight snack.
For you.
In truth, I do snack at midnight, but if I get really hungry, I usually have a spoonful of peanut butter at night because it holds me over.
I can attest.
And I have to admit, I like the honey roasted peanut butter that you can do fresh out of the grinder at Whole Foods.
I know you do.
I do.
I don't think anyone's going to judge you for that.
But I could make my own, and I know I could make my own. I could put a bunch of – I could roast up some peanuts. I could put them in a food processor with some honey and make my own. But for some reason, I don't.
Well, you are a busy man. We'll go with that.
That's no excuse.
We will go.
You know what I need is a good woman to take care of me and, you know, like make my honey roasted peanut butter and stuff like that.
All right, interwebs, should we start a hashtag to find Alton a good woman? Woman for AB.
Oh, I'm not worthy. I'm not worthy. All right, another question.
All right, I like this one. This kind of comes back to the roots of, you know, you went to culinary school.
I did.
Back in the day. I like this one. I like this one a lot because I don't think we've ever really talked about this, but it has been, it's been in on social a bunch. There's a lot of, I feel like when it comes to back to school time and fall time, people kind of go back to basics. And Jason Ortiz from Facebook asked to list the 5 mother sauces in descending order of your most favorite to least favorite in terms of flavor. I like that.
Well, first off, there are multiple lists.
That is true.
Of mother sauces. There are some lists that consider mayonnaise to be a mother sauce. There are some lists that refer to, well, I think all of the lists that I know of refer to
I think
holidays,
that's a new addition, though, isn't it?
Well, you know, I've seen lists, mother sauce lists in French cookbooks that say Bernaise is a mother sauce. And by the way, I vastly prefer Bernaise, a good Bernaise, or a Beurre Blanc. To a hollandaise, because we're talking about a hot – well, it doesn't matter.
Well, let's – instead of, you know, skipping and looking at time, right. Tell me what your favorite and least favorite is. Let's just do favorite and least favorite.
Well, I'm going to base them not on what's my favorite to eat, but my favorite to work with.
Fair enough.
My favorite is always going to be bechamel because it is so versatile. It's so versatile. You can do anything with it. Whereas, look, how often do you make a velouté? You don't make a velouté because you didn't got white stock. Nobody, I mean, it's very difficult to do at home. So it's an Espanol or a brown sauce because, yeah, it's easy to make a roux. But beef stock is not something that most people have at home.
Bechamel.
So I'm going to go with bechamel. And I'm saying bechamel because you know what you can make. If you can make bechamel.
Oh, I know what you can make.
You can make a freaking croque monsieur. And if in that.
Or madame, if that's your
preference. Madame. If you want to dump an egg on there, it's absolutely fine. Or, you know, of course, that translates to Mr. Crunchy, which is in the new book, is an everyday cook. I believe that to be one of the finest eating experiences known to man. So, and of course, if you stick cheese in a bechamel, you've got more than A. And that's. A, you know what I'm saying?
I know what you're saying.
But do you?
I always do, somehow.
Wasn't like Tom Cruise's first Rebecca de Mornay, right? Oh, that was Mornay. Mornay, what was her name? Rebecca de Mornay?
If you could only see my face and Rebecca,
does that mean Rebecca
right
of Mornay sauce?
How did you
even? Have you never seen Risky Business?
No comment, no.
Are you serious? You've never seen the movie Risky Business?
I know, I have not.
Oh my God, Risky Business is an amazingly great film. There's some amazing acting that. And the woman that plays the call girl, Rebecca de Mornay, I'm just wondering if she comes from like the family of Mornay. Saw it.
Okay.
You should watch Risky Business.
I'll put it on my to-do list.
Listeners, can you believe that she hasn't seen? I mean, who hasn't seen Risky Business? Music by the band Tangerine Dream. Breakthrough soundtrack.
I think we'll have to do a must.
Guido the Killer Pimp. Come on, guys. Guido the Killer Pimp. I think we all. And listen, guys who are listening to this, whoever rode a subway train the same way after seeing Risky Business, nobody. I'm telling you. There's a train scene. That's all you need to know.
All right. I'm going to close it off there because.
It's going to tie it off.
I'm just, yeah.
Is that it? No more questions?
Oh, there's plenty of questions, but I think you've gone far enough.
And it's only 13 minutes. Make a short one. I'll give a short answer, and I won't talk about trains.
You always go off on.
No, I won't. Give me one more. Give me one more question, and I'll be like concise and clear, and everything will be fine.
All right. My own question then, putting Risky Business aside.
Yes.
One fall movie that must be watched.
Okay. It's funny that when you say fall movie, the film that jumps immediately to mind for me, and it's not, I'm going to be honest, it's not a movie that I necessarily love, but for some reason, when you say fall movie, what I immediately see in my head is an amazingly young Donald Sutherland jogging in Fallen Leaves. And it's from the first movie that Robert Redford ever directed called Ordinary People. Timothy Hutton won the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor. Very young Timothy Hutton. But I would say Ordinary People. Ordinary People seems to constantly have leaves falling around it. And Robert Redford did that on purpose. He did that for a very specific reason, not only for the color palette, but the kind of this transitional time from life to death. And so I would say that's I'm going to go with Ordinary People.
All right. That's everyone's watch list for this podcast.
Risky Business followed by Ordinary People. And yeah. I think they both take place in Chicago.
Let's discuss it on social.
We're going to take it to social. All right. Well, that's all the time we have. Thanks for listening to the Alton Browncast, where we bring hopefully interesting conversation, culinary questions, and, well, kind of just whatever the hell I want to do.
A lot of sidetracking.
But, hey, that's what the internet is all about. Listen to you next time.